You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, filling in for Leonard Lopate. According to author Frank Partnoy, there's a simple solution to almost every problem. And that's it. You see what I just did there? I took a pause. I waited, if you will. That's what his whole book is about. It's called Wait, and it's a scientific and serious testament to the effectiveness of delaying action, reaction, judgment, and comment. Boy, I need to read this book. His book is published by Public Affairs, and I'm so glad it brings Frank to our studio today. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, and I enjoyed that pause. Nicely done.
You enjoyed the pause. Now, this book is such a mind blower because we live in a culture that demonizes procrastination and glorifies doing everything yesterday. Our reaction time is supposed to be so fast. I was shocked to discover when I was reading this book that procrastination was not always considered a bad thing. That this is a recent sickness in our culture that we blame procrastinators. When was procrastination ever considered a good thing?
It's for most of human history, it's been considered a good thing. Going back to the Greeks and Romans, procrastination was a source of wisdom. People who would take their time and sit and think through problems, they were regarded as the thoughtful leaders of society. And then we had the Anglo-Americans start screwing things up with the Puritan work ethic. A Stitch in Time Saves Nine. Jonathan Edwards wrote this sermon about procrastination, started making us all feel very guilty about procrastinating. And then in the 1970s, this anti-procrastination industry burst onto the scene, telling us to get things done and do it now. And since then, we've been made to feel guilty about putting things off. And over the last few years, as the crush of technology has overwhelmed people and we have all of the, you know, just following your tweets alone it takes up is almost a full-time job. But social media plus email is leading all of us to respond faster and faster and faster. And one of the things I wanted to do is try to give people an excuse to slow down, to delay and procrastinate.
Well, you know, you mentioned technology and our connectiveness as being a big villain in this, but it seems it's sort of a villain in both directions because we now are connected 24/7, so we can respond sooner than we really should in a very impulsive way. But also, we have now this mountain of tasks that builds up because we have so many ways of getting new instructions and new things we have to do. So we also procrastinate and feel terrible about it.
It's a lethal combination, isn't it? It's just getting worse. And I think a lot of people are struggling with this pressure. But the word procrastination has become so negative. But if you think about it, procrastination is really part of the human condition. We're all stuck with more things to do than we could possibly do at one time. And so we have to prioritize. We have to figure out what we're going to procrastinate, what we're going to put off. And there's a kind of art to that, right? But why should we feel guilty about it if we've made a good choice? If somebody's curing cancer today, why should we care if their closet has been dirty for a month?
Right. Like, well, we can prioritize these tasks. You know, when you sat down to write this book, were you thinking, well, procrastinators, that's a pretty huge demographic. That's pretty much 100% of the book buying public. This is going to be a monstrous hit because really I haven't seen anyone else praise procrastination or delay.
Well, I didn't seek out to write the book with that audience in mind. And I'm not sure that everyone is a procrastinator. I mean, we feel guilty about it when we do it, but not everyone is maybe as bad as I am. I've been an inveterate procrastinator for a long time, and I hope I'm in good company with a lot of other people. But one of the things that I really wanted to do was to help people who feel bad or feel guilty about putting things off to let them know that often what they're doing in putting something off is doing the rational, smart thing, and that there are experts in all areas of society who are procrastinating, sometimes in the very short term, sometimes in the very long term. It goes to very basic questions where we're sometimes told to react right away and it's not the right thing. So, for example, the question of when you should apologize for doing something wrong. We're told you should apologize right away. That's what we learned as kids, right? Say you're sorry right away on the playground. And often saying you're sorry right away is the right thing to do. If you have accidentally spilled a drink on someone,
right.
There's water being brought into the studio right now as we're talking. And if I accidentally spilled that on you, I should say I'm sorry right away. But for most serious transgressions, studies show that you should delay as long as possible. Don't say you're sorry until the last possible minute. And the reason is that gives people a chance to understand all the information about what you've done and then a chance to vent. And without that, an early apology, a snap apology, will not be as genuine or as effective.
I'm Andy Borowitz, and I'm filling in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. And I'm talking to Frank Partnoy about the joys of procrastination delay. I hope this is relaxing the audience as they realize what they've been doing instinctively has been a good thing.
They don't have to do anything else.
You know, you brought up this issue of apology and making a quick apology, and immediately I had to bring up the issue of Anthony Weiner, because you discussed this issue. Now, he seems, I mean, not to beat up on him all over again, but he seems like a real victim of a number of the syndromes you talk about in the book. Heavy Twitter user. Twitter lends itself to impulsive bad decisions. I can say as a frequent tweeter, that's definitely the case. So he didn't really think before he checked, for example, to see whether he was direct messaging somebody on Twitter or sending this to everybody in the world. It turned out to be the latter. But then his apology was also very impulsive, you think. It happened fast. And he first kind of, you know, lied a little bit and said, well, this is all, you know, I've been hacked. And I guess that was just an out-and-out lie, which is maybe a topic of another book.
But he didn't respond truthfully.
Right. I liked that was a good spin.
We'll treat it like President Clinton's response to
exactly.
The Michael Lewinsky scandal as well, right? Maybe he thought in some way he was spinning the truth. But
right. But then he came right out with an apology. Then what was wrong with the speed of his apology?
Well, the biggest problem was the snap response initially, not just the one with the underpants, the mm-hmm. later one of denying. That was what he did right away, and he lost credibility once he denied that he had done this. And by that time, he was done. That his mm-hmm. initial reaction was denial instead of acknowledgement. What people who study apologies say is the first thing you should do is not apologize, but acknowledge what you did. Mm-hmm. And so it's really interesting, I think, to put what he did against, for example, what Tracy Morgan did. They both took about the same time in responding to a problem. Listeners might remember Tracy Morgan in one of his comedy routines said he'd stab his son if his son were gay. And he was caught doing that. And instead of lying about it instantly or snap reacting, he let the media cycle play out. He acknowledged that he had done it. He waited about the same time Anthony Weiner did, actually, probably 4 or 5 days. But he gave people time to process why he had done it. He gave people time to vent. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he fessed up and he apologized, and he's been successful and able to go on, and people understood that in context. There's a whole section about politicians' sexual transgressions, sort of a playbook of how politicians have done this. Politicians are notoriously bad at timing their apologies. Not everyone in the media is good, too. Mel Gibson really botched his apology when he had the drunken anti-Semitic slur when he was pulled over by a cop.
How did he handle that in a way that was that worked to his disadvantage?
He apologized right away in a generic way. He snapped. He said, oh no, I've got to get the apology out there. He had his press agent draft a not particularly compelling generic apology that went out right away the next day. And neither of the two things that I just described that are important in apologies had happened. People hadn't processed information about what he had done, exactly what he had said, and why.
Right.
And nobody had a chance to vent.
And the generic apology is always, if I offended somebody in saying what I did, I'm sorry. There's always that if, which makes it somehow less than a satisfying apology, because it makes it sound like perhaps you were too easily offended by what I said.
That's the worst word you can use, right?
Maybe but is worse.
Maybe but is worse, but if is about the as bad a word as you can use in an apology.
Well, isn't there a problem? You know, you talk about the news cycle. There's the 24-hour news cycle was bad enough when there was cable news, but now with the internet and Twitter especially, which is so vicious and so fast, doesn't that put more pressure on these public figures to react quickly and impulsively, because I think, oh my God, everybody is on me, when in reality, if they just waited, Twitter would move on to somebody else, you know, in 24 hours.
It does put pressure on them, and I think they're not particularly wise about it often, that they're giving in to their hardwired, instinctive, reflexive responses. And that's not the right thing to do. And like you say, one of the reasons why we should procrastinate often is that whatever problem we're addressing might go away. So you get an email, you get asked to do something. If you're always responding instantaneously, then you're going to end up doing things that might have gone away, might not have ended up being a big deal. The Twitter universe might have moved on to their next victim if you just delay long enough.
Well, I'm speaking with Frank Partnoy about how we can make better decisions by delaying them, which sounds like a good idea to me. His book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay, is published by Public Affairs. We'll be back with more after a break. This is Andy Borowitz. I'm filling in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Frank Partnoy, who has written a great new book all about the power and wisdom of delay. His new book is called Wait. And let me ask you, you know, I had an interesting call from a listener who was wondering about parents intervening too quickly with their children's problems when their child has a problem, just jumping right in these, you know, helicopter parents or however you want to describe them. And you talk a lot about early child development and child behavior, which can be predictive of an adult's ability to delay gratification and things like that. But before we get to that, what about this issue that the caller brings up? Because that's a good point. I have a 2-year-old at home, and I know that whenever she seems upset about the littlest thing, I want to immediately solve it right then and there because, you know, parents can't stand to see their kids unhappy. What about that? Should we be, while our child is crying, should we be waiting around for some wisdom to set in, or should we maybe kiss their boo-boo, or what should we be doing?
Well, it's always a balance, right? And if your kid is in danger or distress, you want to help them and comfort them. But there's a lot of literature that suggests that what we want our children to be able to do is develop this ability to delay gratification, to understand timing. They develop this ability over time very slowly. So a 2-year-old isn't going to have very much of that. But in a couple of years, you might want to watch out, because studies that, for example, the famous marshmallow studies, where 4-year-olds who were given the choice of one marshmallow right away or a second marshmallow in 15 minutes. If they could wait 15 minutes, they'd get a second marshmallow. Those kids who are able to delay 15 minutes to get the second marshmallow end up doing better on the SAT 14 years later. They end up making more money. They have happier marriages. They're less likely to be addicted to drugs. They end up more emotionally stable. So this early kind of intervention that we as parents want to do, helping our kids along, is a good thing initially, but we need to wean ourselves off of our kids as they get older so that they develop their own ability to delay gratification so that later on they can become more independent.
Well, now you've just put a lot of pressure on all the parents out there to make sure their children will do well on that marshmallow test. So what can we be doing before then to make sure that we have, you know, a 4-year-old who really aces the marshmallow test?
The problem is I'm not sure you can do a lot to engineer the marshmallow test. And one of the issues is that a lot of this behavior is hardwired in kids. There was a study done by a neuroscientist named Stephen Porges where he took a bunch of 9-month-olds and gave them standard tests on the Bayley Scales, infant development, and asked parents questions on a questionnaire. And then he retested the kids at 3 years. But in addition to the standard tests at 9 months, he measured something called their heart rate variability. He basically measured how fast they're able to adjust their heart rates. And what he found was that at 3 years, the standard tests wouldn't predict whether a nightmare child would still be a nightmare child. Kids would be beautifully behaved at 9 months and then horribly behaved at 3 years. But the thing that would predict behavior at 3 years was this biological hardwired reaction, which was their ability to manipulate their heart rates by just milliseconds to speed up and slow down their heart rates, sort of like having a high-performance car that can speed up and slow down. And so what a lot of people are saying in response to that you might want to do with a 2-year-old is just to make sure that they feel safe, that they feel comfortable. And some kinds of things that can scare a 2-year-old or a 9-month-old, like a scary Halloween costume or mask or yelling, get away from the stove, those are things we might think of as protecting our kids, but they can interpret them as being dangerous, and that can mute their ability to regulate their heart rate. And this crazy thing, being able to regulate your heart rate by milliseconds, ends up being a predictor of emotional health later in life.
How do they stumble on that? That seems like such a kind of obscure metric to decide upon. Were they just hooking up the kids to all kinds of monitors while they were doing these tests, or what was the process for that? It's fascinating.
It's an amazing story, and this guy Stephen Porges was very skeptical 25 years ago of research in psychology and thought that you could tell a lot more about patients by measuring their bodies rather than listening to them. He didn't trust putting people on a sofa and asking them about their childhood three days a week. And so he didn't start with kids. He started with adults, just measuring heart rate variability, and he invented a mechanism to measure how fast our heart rates will accelerate and decelerate. And according to him and others, this might become just like our blood pressure or our other blood tests, you know, our cholesterol or the Apgar tests that are given to kids in terms of predicting our mental health in the same way those tests predict our physical health. They have withstood the test of time so far as a good predictor. And the first time I heard this, I just couldn't believe it, that heart rate variability would matter so much, but it turns out that it does.
Now, with this book, you're becoming, at least to my mind, sort of the anti-Malcolm Gladwell, because Malcolm Gladwell wrote the bestseller Blink, which was all about first impressions and the value of first impressions, and you're suggesting in Wait that first impression may be only show you part of the picture. It's not necessarily a call to action. What's the value of a first impression in your construct?
They can be incredibly valuable, and Malcolm Gladwell in Blink was writing about the first 2 seconds. He talks in that book about the importance of the first 2 seconds. And we can tell a lot of information, but 2 seconds is not a magical moment of time or period of time. Often to judge people, to make an initial impression, seeing a face, to make a judgment about race or gender or sexual orientation, we don't need anything close to 2 seconds. And we're often reasonably accurate in 100 milliseconds. But part of the danger of that is that we're not entirely accurate, and that 2 seconds might give us some information, but 5 seconds gives us more, 10 seconds more. There's this notion of thin slicing that Malcolm Gladwell talked about, that is our ability to make an impression or draw a conclusion based on a thin slice of information. Mm-hmm. But what scientists have found in the last few years since Blink was published is that the kind of thin slicing that we do should be thicker.
Thicker thin slicing.
A minute or 5 minutes is a better period of time than 2 seconds. That our snap reactions are often wrong or dangerous. That there are lots of subliminal influences in our lives. For example, if I subliminally flash a fast food logo at you, okay, you don't realize you've seen it, but you are seeing a McDonald's logo just for a few milliseconds. That will make you read 20% faster. It'll make you enjoy music less. It'll make you less patient. It'll make you enjoy looking at photographs less. That there are all these stimulations in our environment where we're hardwired to snap react and take in huge amounts of information, but that they lead us astray and can be very dangerous. So one of the things I wanted to do in Wait was to give people a more balanced view of what the dangers of snap decision making are, and also show some of the benefits, but explain what the relevant time frame is. Psychologists, behavioral economists, neuroscientists, they've told us a lot about how we make decisions, why we make decisions, what kinds of decisions we should make. They haven't told us very much about when. Mm-hmm. And so what I wanted to do in this book is give people a sense of when.
Well, you know, you talk about subliminal images a lot in the book, which I hadn't really thought that much about. And I guess that's the whole nature of a subliminal image, is we don't think about it. They're being received in some dark caverns of our mind, but having a tremendous effect. And I'd like to break the first rule of Fight Club and talk about Fight Club. Can we talk about this?
Okay, we'll do it.
You get into the movie quite a bit in the book, but there are all these subliminal images in the movie. What was the purpose of that? How were they uncovered? Is this common in commercials and in movies? What's the origin of the subliminal images in Fight Club?
So if you haven't seen the movie and you want to, cover your ears, but I won't reveal the ending. But one of the plot elements in Fight Club is whether or not a sexually explicit subliminal image will influence people. So you're taking your family to go see a film, and there's a person working in the booth who has spliced a milliseconds long shot of a sexually explicit image. And one of the questions in the film is, well, what impact will that have on you? And people loved Fight Club. I loved Fight Club. And there's a kind of cult following that analyzed frame by frame what these – and there are subliminal images all over the film. And so scientists actually study this as well, and they try to figure out what it is you can do to confront a subliminal image when it's being flashed in front of you, but you don't realize it. And what they found was you can confront it best if you keep your mind active. If your brain is full and you're fully engaged in watching the movie or thinking hard about something, then your mind is going to be less permeable. The subliminal image isn't going to be able to get inside and work your brain because your brain's already busy.
Right.
And so one of the key things to do is to keep your – if you're worried about subliminal advertising or these messages is to keep an active mind, and that will help shield you from these kinds of images.
Now, we got an interesting question on our show page. This actually gives you a chance to give some practical advice about procrastination, doing things right away. A listener writes that that they're tempted to do things right away when the thought occurs to them because they don't want to forget to do them. That's a temptation. And is there a process that you have for, you know, keeping track of tasks and doing them down the line? I mean, it can be as simple, I guess, as writing them down, but nobody does that really. I mean, is that a trap that people say, oh, I've got to buy something, and so they quickly go online and just grab something faster. They do something impulsive because they're afraid that they're not going to remember it down the line. They might make a more reasoned judgment, better decision down the line.
It is a trap, and it's such a great question. And through the 3 years of research on this book, I have changed my behavior quite a bit. And I'll just give you an example, which is that I get emails in my inbox, and I always ask the book talks about a two-step process, which is the first question is, what's the longest amount of time I can wait for responding? So before responding to this email. And then the second point is, wait as long as you can within that period of time. Mm-hmm. So when I get an email, maybe this is rude to some people who are emailing me, but I think, do I need to respond instantaneously, or could this wait a day or a week? And then what I'll do, just as a practical matter, I don't know if it'll work for your listener, but I take whatever content there is in the email and I just cut and paste it into my calendar for a day or two from then. And then I file the email away so I don't have to see it. And there are a couple of good things about that. One is that the reminder is there. You don't have to worry about your memory. But the other is that your brain will keep working on that problem. Your brain will actually think about how you should respond to the email. Even if you're not consciously processing it, you'll get to take in extra information during this time period you've freed yourself up for. And we're all inundated by requests for our time. We can't possibly respond to everything instantaneously. So one of the things I wanted to try to show people is that the most successful and happiest people, particularly senior executives and senior officials in government, they do exactly this. They take, when they're asked to do something, the very first thing they do is say, oh no, I'm not going to do that now.
Right.
I mean, I've had so many senior executives tell me the right thing to do with your inbox is simply to take everything in your inbox and move it to your outbox. That 99% of the time you'll have done exactly the right thing. And I'm not advocating being irresponsible about it. But I do think this idea of rather than having time manage you or delay manage you, sort of grabbing delay by the throat and saying, I'm going to decide when I respond to this email or when I'm going to do this task is a wise way to go.
See, my brain has been so destroyed by technology that if I email you and you don't get back to me within 4 seconds, I assume you hate me. That's I always come to that conclusion. So you've just given the audience some terrible advice for dealing with me and creating unhappiness. I have to ask you, since you bring up executives, and I know you worked in the investment banking world, speed of decision-making is king in investment banking. I mean, there are now computers that are making decisions within milliseconds and huge trades. And we've, you know, recently seen with our meltdown in 2008, and I think something happened in the news maybe a few weeks ago where Morgan Stanley or Chase, rather, J.P. Morgan Chase lost several $1 billion in a bad bet. Is the speed of the decision making wreaking havoc in this world, or is there a way to unring the bell at this point now that everybody is competing to make decisions so quickly?
I think there has to be, and I think you've put your finger on something really important, and it actually is what led me to Right Weight. I work in the financial markets area. I teach about finance and business. And one of the things I did right after the financial crisis hit was to interview some senior executives at Lehman Brothers. And it turns out they had designed a decision-making course mm-hmm. for their senior executives. They took 4 dozen executives and shipped them over to the Palace Hotel on Madison Avenue. They brought in a bunch of very smart people from Harvard, actually. They were almost all from Harvard to talk about psychology and snap decision-making. They brought in Malcolm Gladwell to mm-hmm. give the capstone lecture about Blink. Right? He had just published Blink. This was fall of 2005. And then they rushed back to their headquarters in Times Square and made the worst snap decisions in the history of financial markets. And so one of the things I want to try to do is to, with Wait, was to recraft a course for Wall Street to get people on Wall Street to understand that they shouldn't be snap decision-making in this way, that they need to be thinking about the longer term. We just went through this enormous crisis where 8 million people lost jobs and we had to bail out these banks. And
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it wasn't good, right? And they need to be taking their time and be more thoughtful and strategic about long-term decision-making.
Well, I have to ask one last question, which I know is important to you. Should listeners wait to buy this book, or should they buy it immediately without thinking? What's your preference?
Well, sometime today would be good, but maybe not right this second. Maybe you could wait 5 minutes. That might be the right time
frame. 5 minutes. Okay. Well, your publisher will hate you for saying that. Thanks so much for coming. I've been speaking with Frank Partnoy about his book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. It's published by Public Affairs. And I want to thank you so much for coming in. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.